For the girls remaining in Orange, there was no such forgetfulness. In a way, they wanted to remember Quinta. On Tuesday, 10th of December, Edna, Albina and Grace arrived at St. Venantius Church for her funeral. The variance in their fortunes was clear for the waiting reporters to see. Grace walked briskly and unaided, while Edna seemed to be the most affected by the disease. For Albina, this was the second sister she had lost to radium poisoning, and even to attend was a struggle. Yet she was determined to pay her respects. There was a long flight of stairs leading to the church door, but Albina fought her way up every single step, even though she was apparently near collapse. This was more important than her comfort. This was for Quinta. It was a brief service. Helen and Robert, the MacDonald children, kept close to their father, both too young to realise their loss, yet sensing. In the weeks to come, they would indeed have a Christmas they would never forget. Immediately after the Mass, the family and close friends progressed to Rosedale Cemetery, where Quinta would join her sister Molly in rest. It was a simple burial, without fuss, as she would have wanted. There was one other thing she had asked for. She wanted her death to be of service to her friends. She could thus, said Ethel sadly, leave a parting gift to other victims. And so Martland conducted an autopsy and discovered that Quinta had died from the same rare sarcoma that had killed Ella Eckert. Quinta's may not have been on her shoulder, but it was the same thing. It was just that the radium had chosen a different target in her bones. Martland gave a statement about this new threat. The bones of the victims, he revealed, had actually died before they did. One might have thought that on learning of Quinta's death, this woman the company doctors had professed was not going to die. The United States Radium Corporation might, at last, have softened. But you would be wrong. Berry did manage to win a settlement for May Canfield in the new year of $8,000, but the company had a straitjacket clause attached. The only way they would pay his client any money, they said, was if Berry himself was incorporated into the deal. He was far too knowledgeable about their activities and becoming far too skilled in court to be left off a leash. And so Raymond Berry, legal champion, the pioneering attorney who had been the only lawyer to answer Grace's call for help, found himself forced into signing his name to the following statement. I agree not to be connected with, directly or indirectly, any other cases against the United States Radium Corporation, nor to render assistance to any persons in any actions against said company, nor to furnish data or information to any such persons in matters against said company. Berry was gone. He had been a serious fighter against the firm, an irksome thorn in their side. But now, with surgical precision, they had plucked him out and banished him. They were two settlements down, but the United States Radium Corporation was winning the war. Chapter 36, Ottawa, Illinois, 1930. Catherine Wolfe gave a huge sigh and rubbed her hands in tiredness over her face and along her short, dark hair. She watched idly as the clouds of radium dust flew up around her from the layer on her desk, disturbed by her discontented sigh. Then she returned reluctantly to weighing out the material for the girls. Catherine wasn't a full-time dial painter anymore. The change in her duties had been directed by the studio bosses. They'd been good to her, really, she thought. Mr. Reed had been so understanding. He'd called her in to see him one day last year and said that, on account of her poor health, She was to take a 6-week vacation.